course.
Great, thank you. Thanks for inviting me to talk to your group. Thanks to all of you for taking time to participate in this event. I think that what we've done here with the study is try to document systematically something that we suspected and perhaps some of you suspected might be true. And it's important to document systematically things to see if they're the things that we're observing anecdotally actually are patterns that are systematic. So the thing that we suspected to be true is that we suspected that there was a problem with anti-Semitism among the people who have official responsibilities at universities to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion. So we've actually been doing a series of studies at the Heritage Foundation on diversity, equity, inclusion. The first actually was called Diversity University. The second was called Equity Elementary, and the third was called Inclusion Delusion. It's this third Inclusion Delusion paper that we're talking about today. So the first paper, Diversity University, we tried to get a sense of how large the diversity effort was at universities. And so we simply counted the number of DEI staff at 65 universities that are members of the Power Five Athletic Conferences. We chose the Power Five Athletic Conferences because sports is the most important thing about universities. So we chose those universities. Actually, we chose them because these are not the most elite universities. I mean, some are. There are some, Duke and Northwestern are in the Power Five. But they're mostly state flagship universities that are the kinds of universities that people go to not out of any ideological commitment, but just because they live in a state. And so these 65 universities are very large, mostly public universities that encompass a very large proportion of all students enrolled in a four-year higher education experience. So we counted the number of DEI staff, and we found that on average there were 45 diversity, equity, and inclusion staff at these universities. And this is by a very conservative count. That is, we did not count any of the people involved in legal compliance. So no Title IX officers or other people who are there to ensure that a university is not sued for discrimination. We did not count those people. We also did not count any of the faculty or academic department staff that are part of ethnic and gender studies departments at these universities, which, although they may be promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion goals, their primary responsibilities ostensibly are to engage in the traditional academic activities of teaching and research. Instead, we just counted people listed on these university websites as having a responsibility to promote the political and social goals of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And on average, that's turned out to be 45. So we came up with a list of 3,000 roughly names and titles of diversity, equity, and inclusion staff at these 65 universities. So in the most recent paper, Inclusion Delusion, that we're talking about today, we wanted to find out if these DEI staff are engaged in possessing and expressing anti-Semitic attitudes. And now measuring anti-Semitism is actually quite challenging. And one of the main challenges is that the traditional measure of anti-Semitism in most research is simply to ask people, ask them if they agree with some anti-Semitic stereotypes. You think Jews are responsible for causing wars or control international banking. And to the extent that people say they agree with those stereotypes, they're deemed to be anti-Semitic. You can see there's an obvious problem in this approach, which is that people may not tell you about their anti-Semitism. So a better way to approach anti-Semitism that I've adopted in some other earlier research that we could also talk about, but also in this study, a better way to approach this is to catch people in unguarded moments so that they can tell you about their anti-Semitism if they possess it without you having to ask them. And so what we did is we decided to look at the social media communications, particularly the Twitter feeds of these DEI staff. So we searched for their DEI accounts. We were able to find 741 viewable DEI staff Twitter accounts. Now, of course, that's only a portion of the 3,000 total. That's true. But again, finding only a portion is often what we do in survey research, is that we only find a portion of people. We only can get a portion of people to answer us. So, of course, then we have to consider, is the portion that we saw like the portion that we didn't see? And that's something we can talk about further if you have concerns about that. But in any event, we found 741 Twitter accounts. And then we searched those Twitter accounts for all references to Israel, and for comparison purposes, all references to China. And what we found is two main results. One, that DEI staff are relatively obsessed with Israel compared to China. That is, they tweet, retweet, or like things on Twitter three times as much about Israel as China. This despite the fact that they have many reasons to be paying more or at least as much attention to China as to Israel. They're relatively obsessed with Israel, paying attention to it and communicating about it three times as much as China. Second, and more strikingly, they're almost universally critical of Israel when they reference Israel. 96% of all tweets, retweets, and likes from these accounts were critical of the Jewish state, while 62% of all tweets referencing China were actually favorable about the communist state. And so it's not just this incredible disparity between how DEI staff felt about Israel relative to China and their almost universal criticism of Israel that struck us, but also the intemperate language that we often found in these tweets. That is, they regularly invoked themes of genocide, accusing Israel of being an apartheid state, and making references to Israeli policy being like Nazi policy, accusing Israel of engaging in intentional targeting of children, invoking classic child sacrifice tropes. And so we looked at this pattern, both of intemperate language and the disparate criticism of Israel relative to China, and we see that as evidence of anti-Semitism. Now we can talk about whether you agree with that interpretation or not, but at a minimum, they're universally critical of Israel, but we think that again, double standard criticism of Israel relative to another country, plus the references to genocide, Nazis, also make what we are observing not simply legitimate criticism of the policies of the state of Israel, but actually crossing the line into showing a clear pattern of anti-Semitism. Now, there's been some criticism of this study, just so you're aware of it, and let me try to anticipate that criticism. One law professor at Northwestern criticized the study, saying, well, you only look at 741 accounts, you only find a certain number of tweets, some of the people may be multiple tweeters, and therefore you may even be getting a smaller number, and therefore this is not evidence of a widespread problem. And I think that misunderstands the empirical analysis. This empirical analysis should be understood as being like survey research. So in survey research, you ask people to complete a survey, and some people refuse, and some people agree. And then what you do is you take the group that agrees and you ask them the question, and you have to make assumptions that the people who agree to answer your questions are like the people who don't agree. And then the people who do agree to answer the questions, they give you answers, and you then have to believe that the answers they give you actually reflect their true sentiments. So in this case, rather than than asking people to answer our questions. We let them volunteer it. Now, some people volunteered it and some people did not. We have to make the assumption that the people who volunteered their sentiment about Israel reflect the same attitudes as the people who did not volunteer, just like the people who answer a survey question, a survey questionnaire have to be assumed to be like the people who declined to answer it. So the important thing is not the count of people who answer the question or who volunteer their attitudes about Israel or about Jews, but the proportion. And the proportion is overwhelming, 96% critical, and highly disproportionate relative to criticism of China, where actually it's 62% favorable. And I think that's the thing to be paying attention to, is the proportion and the disparity in that proportion, not the count. Focusing on the count would be akin to saying that if 60% of a survey of 1,000 people said something, that, well, it was only 600 people, and there are 350 million people in the country, it's not very many people. Paying attention to the count is not the appropriate way to think about survey research, but instead it's the proportion who answer in a certain direction, and then the only question remaining is the sample that you observed like the sample you did not observe, which I think in this case, I think we have good reason to believe that we're capturing a fairly good slice of all DEI staff at universities. So anyway, I think that basically covers what we found. Now, as to what could be done about this, well, it's not clear to me that there are easy policy answers to this problem. The growth in diversity, equity, and inclusion staff at universities has been gaining speed, but it's largely been gaining speed not out of an ideological commitment, I think, on the part of central administration, but out of response to pressure from activist groups on campus and off. That is, I'm inclined to believe that central administrators at universities are not deeply ideologically committed people, but that they tend to be careerist, ambitious, and if they receive political pressure from in one direction and there are potential liabilities to their career out of not appeasing that pressure, that's the direction they're going to go. And so I think that's the pressure that they've been receiving more intensely lately, but for a long time, and that has fueled the growth in DEI staff. And DEI staff has grown in a number of different directions. So it's the creation of additional centers focused on different identities has been one way it's expanded. The number of people within each of these centers has expanded over time, and then even the levels. These centers then needed someone on top of them to adjudicate issues among them and allocation of resources among them. So universities created chief diversity officers and a whole staff around the chief diversity officer, usually located in something like the provost office. So there would be a vice provost for diversity or something like that. But now that this whole infrastructure is being replicated at the college level in many universities, so that you see colleges of business, colleges of engineering, creating their own diversity, chief diversity officers, and their own different identity centers within the colleges as well. Another interesting pattern, by the way, that we've observed in a more recent study where we look at the indirect costs of research grants is that universities with higher indirect revenue are also universities that have larger DEI staff. That basically, DEI staff is something that university administrators are able to purchase when they're more awash in resources. And so universities with larger research grant revenue are and colleges that have more research grant revenue tend to be the places where you see more DEI staff. Now, I think one other issue that I should anticipate that may come up in questions is, how do we know that what DEI staff say in their unguarded communications on Twitter are reflective of anything that they would be doing in their professional responsibility on campus? And the truth is, we can't make a direct connection there. We don't have that evidence. We can nonetheless find it worrisome that people who have a professional responsibility to reduce the incidence of hate and bias on campus are themselves engaged in hate and bias in their own social media communications. And let me also be clear that these social media communications are not private communications. These are public communications. They're just unguarded public communications. Anyone can read them. We were able to read them. People on campus, students, faculty might be reading them, and that might be giving them guidance as to what kind of behavior is acceptable on campus. And that may help facilitate the incidence of anti-Semitic behavior that we are seeing on campus by the people who have a professional responsibility to set the example of reducing hate and bias instead of setting the example of promoting it, at least with respect to Jews. So again, what can be done about this? I think the thing that can be done about this is to apply pressure to central administration in the other direction, rather than them receiving only pressure to expand DEI efforts. They might receive some pressure to rein in those efforts, and also to get them to be more consciously aware of the ways in which they might be promoting anti-Semitism through their social media communications, but also through activities they do on campus. So I think this pressure could be applied to central administration from state legislators, as well as from major donors or alumni, or parents, simply parents who write tuition checks, faculty who work at universities. All of these groups can use the kind of information that we've produced here, bring it to central administration, and use it to raise questions about whether DEI is actually achieving the laudable goals of diversity and inclusion, whether they're really producing those goals or producing something like the opposite of those goals, again, at least with respect to Jews. So anyway, thank you for letting me describe this research to you. I look forward to hearing your questions and suggestions about this, and I hope that it's useful to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Jay. That's great. And thank you for sharing the research. We have already a lot of questions coming in, so we're gonna go to them in a second. But I'm gonna let Alex ask the first question, and then we'll open up to the audience. So Alex, go ahead.
Sure. Well, first, my thanks as well for a great presentation, a depressing presentation. While you were speaking, I looked it up, and there was an estimate from last summer that the University of California at Berkeley spent $25 million on its DEI enterprise. And I think that speaks to kind of an underlying question that you touched on. How much is ideology and how much is simply grift? And I would say it's both, because it's extremely profitable to promote these kinds of ideologies and approaches. But my question, I think, is has to do with pushing back. And we've seen, you know, the growth of the DEI, not only at universities, but K through 12, local, state, and federal governments, corporations, and so on. Can you look at the situation that's unfolding in the state of Virginia and sure. Suggest whether that is a kind of counterexample that leads the way or whether it's a one-off in some way?
So I think what you're referencing there is Governor Youngkin, who was just sworn into office, campaigned heavily on trying to bring under control some racially inciting approaches to education in the K-12 arena. A number of parent groups organized in Virginia, upset about some of the racial and sexual orientation, gender identity efforts being made by their K-12 schools. They were often not well received by their school boards and had their efforts resisted. And then the Democratic candidate for governor in Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, then said something about how parents really shouldn't control what their kids are taught anyway, and that kind of inflamed a more parent anger, and it may have helped sweep in a kind of a surprise upset victory by the Republican candidate, Youngkin. And he then has come into office and sworn that he would remove these objectionable practices from the K-12 arena, and he also has appointed a new head of diversity, equity, inclusion, who actually came from the Heritage Foundation, but renaming it and changing the emphasis of that organization away from what has been its traditional path. Now, look, there's nothing inherently wrong. In fact, there's much to be praised in trying to promote diversity and inclusion. These can be very good things that we might wish to promote. But I think, as you correctly said in your kind of preamble to the question, Alex, that these efforts are not primarily, I think, about helping welcome new students from different kinds of backgrounds to campus and helping them get along with each other. Instead, it's very clear that DEI efforts on university campuses and increasingly in K-12 spaces are about promoting a particular vision of a political and social agenda. And some people like that agenda and some people don't, but we should be clear that DEI is a political activist enterprise. It is not merely like a student life staff who are there to help make sure that students get along well in the dorm. You know, that's a perfectly legitimate thing for universities to do. It would be perfectly legitimate for universities to want to help students from diverse backgrounds be welcome and get along with each other. But that's not really what these DEI staff are about. So I think we have to recognize the political agenda that they have. We can say whether we like it or not, but we also have to consider whether there are negative side effects of that agenda, including particularly for Jews.
Great, thank you. Alex, I'm going to move on to the audience, if that's okay.
Great.
So I'm going to try to combine a few questions here that have a similar theme, so we can try to get through as many as we can. So both my friend Gunter Jekili at Indiana and Linda Schwartz are asking you, you know, going back to your point about that there were about 90 tweets that were critical of Israel and the 741 number that you were using. They wanted to know, can you talk about the percentages, that had the reference to at least Israel or something about Israel on the Israel angle of the number that you were exploring there, maybe, you know, what the implications of that is.
So the implication of which percentage?
The 741 staff Twitter account that you looked at, you know, where you referenced about the Israel part, you know, which percentage really are, you know, can you talk about going deeper into the or the anti-Israel part, you know, as well? Or,
right. You know, so keep in mind that even among the 741 Twitter accounts we could see, not everyone said anything about Israel or China. Again, these would be like the people who declined to answer a questionnaire. They didn't volunteer their attitudes about Israel. A lot of people don't engage in political comment on Twitter. They might just be tweeting about the football game, or what they had for dinner last night. Also, some people are very inactive on Twitter, and while they had accounts, they had very few tweets. We're only capturing a portion of, there were 3,000 DEI staff. We capture about a quarter of them having Twitter accounts that we can view at all. But even then, only a portion of them are volunteering to us what they think about Israel and what they think about China. Our assumption, and we think this is a reasonable assumption, is that the portion that we are seeing is representative of the portion that we're not. Now, we do have reason to believe that the portion who volunteered their sentiment may differ from the portion who did not in the intensity of their votes. That is, people who care more intensely about an issue might talk about it more, okay? And they might volunteer it more on Twitter. However, there's no reason to think that the people who volunteer their sentiment should be different from the people who don't in the direction of their sentiment. That is, there's no reason to think that people who have favorable things to say about Israel are less likely to communicate it than the people who have unfavorable things, right? They can both communicate it. It's simply intensity of preference might make them more likely to communicate, but not direction of preference. And so that's the assumption of our analysis. Now, if you don't buy that assumption, fine. You don't have to be persuaded. But I think you still have to contend with, you know, what seems like a really overwhelming pattern of several hundred people who have a professional responsibility at a university not to promote hate and bigotry. This would be like if we found, you know, several hundred doctors among, you know, a couple thousand doctors, we found several hundred of them tweeting about how it's a great idea to smoke and mainline heroin, right? I mean, it would be alarming if we were to find such a thing. So even if you weren't convinced that this was a widespread problem, you'd still be alarmed by the existence of the problem nonetheless. Does that help answer, I think, what the question was?
Yeah, that helps. Thank you. We have some of our Canadian colleagues also in the audience, so they're asking, so Charles Feynman and Mondo, I'll try to combine their questions as well here. So Charles is asking about, are these trends in education of administrations also found in other countries like in Canada and the West that you've explored? And Mondo Halpern, who is also from Canada, is also making a point that in Canadian universities, mostly DEI is attentive to Black and Indigenous concerns. And so how do you like kind of deal with that as well? So we made it try to combine those two issues as well.
Right. So I don't have evidence on what the pattern looks like in other countries, including Canada. But I suspect the pattern is probably similar, given that other features of university life are similar enough that we might have reason to think that the same pattern would hold in Canadian universities as in American universities, or US universities, I should say. As to the primary focus of DEI staff, in the US, there is a large attention to the needs of Black students or concerns of related to African-American issues. But there's again been a proliferation of DEI centers to encompass other identities. So there are often at universities centers focused on Hispanic concerns, Native American concerns, Asian concerns, women's concerns, LGBTQ concerns. This is the general pattern. So the efforts kind of originated and are largest with respect to African Americans, but that's not exclusively what it is. And if I had to give a rough guess, it's about half of DEI staff are primarily focused on African American issues, but the other half not.
Great, thank you. Moving on to Deborah Glazer's question here. She's referencing, I'm not sure if you looked at that, what has recently happened at USC, where USC is now, and she quotes here, creating a space for Jewish identities and diversity, equity, and inclusion programming, and form an advisory committee on Jewish life and inclusion that will include faculty members, students, and Jewish groups on campus. As reported here, the advisory will commit, you know, they will convene and, you know, this month to discuss that work. She's asking, you know, whether that resolution of the issue at USC is a role model for universities that we should be demanding regarding, you know, I guess to your last point about things we can do and demand from the central administrations?
Right. No, that's a great question. So my understanding of what happened at USC, there were a variety of incidents, but I think one of the main incidents that led to the steps described is that there was a student government representative who, again, in social media was doing things like saying that she wanted to kill Jews or kill Zionists. And when people objected that this person was a representative in student government, and in fact was the diversity, equity, and inclusion representative for the student government, the administration said, "Well, free speech, we can't do anything about it." And then I think a number of external donors and faculty kind of gathered together and began to apply pressure to USC president, who then ultimately issued a statement calling for the creation of a commission and pledging to expand the role of Jews in DEI activities on campus and improve education efforts. And while I think this is encouraging in the sense that it shows that it's possible to get a coalition together to apply pressure and get university administration to respond, I'm not 100% convinced that the solutions being recommended there are the ones that are likely to be productive. That is, it seems to leave in place the DEI ideology. That is the role of DEI staff as political and social activists on campus. It leaves that infrastructure in place and it leaves that role in place, but simply adds Jews to that. And I'm not sure that that will fix it. In addition, and let me just use this as an opportunity to highlight another piece of research that people might be interested in. It's also clear to me that improved training and education efforts is not likely to be very fruitful in combating anti-Semitism on campus. And the reason for this is that I think we have good reason to believe that anti-Semitism is not largely a function of ignorance. That is, people are not anti-Semitic because they don't know. They're anti-Semitic because it benefits them. And in a study that I did with Albert Cheng, that's in Tablet Magazine and it's forthcoming in the journal Anti-Semitism Studies, what we did is rather than, again, we measured anti-Semitism in an unguarded way. And the way we did that is that we created two scenarios, one Jewish, one non-Jewish, and we randomly assigned people to answer questions either about the Jewish one or the non-Jewish one. No one saw both. No one answered questions about both. They only answered about one or the other. Nonetheless, if the two scenarios were really alike, on average, the group that saw the Jewish one should answer it the same as the one that answered the non-Jewish one. What we found, however, is that the groups answered them differently, particularly if people had higher levels of education, in ways that were hostile towards Jews. So, for example, we asked people if the military could restrict the wearing Jews wearing yarmulkes or Sikhs wearing turbans. Same principle, same basic issue, but we just asked either they saw a question about Jews or they saw a question about Sikhs. If people had higher levels of education, they were much more favorable to restricting Jews from wearing yarmulkes than the also equally highly educated people who were asked the question about Sikhs. They were much more permissive about Sikhs. We asked this about a series of questions, these double standard type questions, and we were able to find that higher education levels are actually associated with higher levels of anti-Semitism, which means that training and education efforts are not the primary solution. The primary solution is a political solution. That is people have to believe that it's not in their political interest, it doesn't benefit them politically to adopt anti-Semitic perspectives. And that's a much harder fight, but I think it's the right fight. Now, how that exactly that's done on university campuses, again, I think some of it has to do with right now, if you hold anti-Semitic attitudes on campuses, you're not punished. And you might, in fact, get rewarded by being hired into DEI staff in one of the DEI centers because of your activism. But pro-Jewish and pro-Zionist students face the opposite incentives. This difference in the benefit and cost might be a bigger part of shaping the anti-Semitism environment on campus than ignorance.
Right. Thank you for that. I mean, there's actually, you know, a good follow-up, a segue to that, you know, just a little bit more, you know, that's coming out of Richard Fulton. I mean, you know, who's asking really, you know, how, you know, given the hostility, you know, what can we do to basically delink, you know, the hostility and the Israel part? And, you know, again, he's following up onto your last point. You know, is there an option, you know, to educate these DEI officials, making themselves not, you know, them part of the problem, or rather part of the solution? I'm adding to the, you know, I know we spoke a little bit about this before we started the webinar today, and obviously, you know, there's a larger problem at large given the religiosity of DEI and what's going on campuses. So is there something, you know, about the hiring process that plays into all of this? You know, we're talking about, you know, the training that happens once they're ready on campus. You know, what, you know, maybe there's a bigger, you know, obviously the bigger question about, we know there's a need by universities to hire these DEI officers. I think Princeton hired maybe 2 years ago a DEI officer in the tone of close to maybe 800 a year, you know, for, you know, a chief diversity officer. I mean, so there's a growing growth industry, you know, in this DEI business. But what can we do about, you know, making sure that they are even able to identify the problems? One of the things that I know, and some of the things that we've explored here at SPME and amongst our colleagues and others, that the issue of, for example, anti-Semitism regarding the IRA definition, when things happen on campuses, mostly falls on the, you know, the desks of these individuals. If they can't identify the problem, what can be done in that respect? If you want to tackle some of those points, that'll be great.
Sure. So, I mean, I think the adoption of the IRA definition of anti-Semitism is a really great concrete goal for people trying to make changes on their campuses. If you can get your university to embrace that definition, I think that's a big win, because then that helps shape the conversation about whether people are basically able to get away with using anti-Zionism as code for anti-Semitism or not. It catches them in doing that by adopting that definition, and I think that's really important. As to the kind of senior diversity staff who are very highly paid, I think those people don't have as deep ideological commitments. They're not as likely to be activists. They're more likely to be kind of career-oriented, ambitious, and therefore malleable on these issues. That is, if they believe that it will be bad for their career to permit this type of anti-Semitism amongst their staff, they'll go in that direction if they think that's the way to have a better career. It's the front line, it's the lower level DEI staff that are more ideologically committed and more activist. Now, I think that there's a mistaken perception by a lot of people that the average student or the average faculty member on campus is in agreement with the frontline DEI staff in their radicalism. And I don't think that's true. I think the average student and the average faculty member are far more centrist and sensible than DEI frontline staff activists. But I think they're silent. And the reason why the average student and the average faculty member is silent is they're fearful. The DEI people have power increasingly because what they do is they articulate and enforce an ideological orthodoxy on campus. And students who are, you know, not ideologically committed, who are not radicals, they don't want to have their career prospects or their academic career ruined by being called out or denounced or otherwise sanctioned for having wrong thoughts. And so they go along, not out of agreement, but out of fear. And the same is true for many faculty members who, frankly, would very much rather not be denounced for something they might say in class or write in a paper. They would prefer autonomy and not to be supervised in this way by DEI staff. And DEI staff articulate and enforce this orthodoxy in part because they do control trainings that signal what is acceptable or unacceptable behavior. And they also provide an address to activists or radical students for where they could go to be organized and have their voices amplified. And so that's the political activism of DEI staff. But I think it's mostly at the front line and not mostly at the high end. And so, look, if we can shrink, honestly, DEI staff a bit to make it so that's not a career path for the radicals on campus, it will reduce significantly the rewards to embrace these very pernicious views.
Great, thank you. Moving on to our colleague Don Ellis's question, who's asking, what accounts as legitimate criticism of Israel but not anti-Semitic? And how do you engage in genuine criticism of Israel without being labeled as anti-Semitic when you're deciphering through all the data that you've been looking at? Or is everything code for anti-Semitism? Is this question.
So I think the IRA definition is what can give us guidance for how we distinguish. Aren't saying that any individual one of these tweets is by itself evidence of anti-Semitism, but the pattern is evidence. So the pattern that we see is first the double standard, the asymmetry, and double standard is part of the IRA definition. That is, if you are denouncing things that Israel does that you wouldn't denounce others for similarly doing, that particular targeting of Israel for criticism is collectively evidence of anti-Semitism. Similarly, the invocation of the accusation that Israel is engaged in genocide or is behaving like Nazis, those are also part of the examples given in the IRA definition of what might constitute anti-Semitism. And again, we see plenty of those in these tweets. So look, Jews worldwide, in Israel and in America, have plenty of criticisms of Israeli government actions. That's just as Americans have plenty of criticisms of American government actions. There's nothing wrong or inherently hateful in criticizing government policy. But if you do it with a particular pattern that the IRA definition helps describe, then it crosses the line into being evidence of hatred of a group and not merely denouncing those particular government actions. I mean, it's a funny little story. A rabbi friend of mine says, and he's Orthodox, so he looks Jewish, and people come up to him and they say they love Israel. And he says, why tell me that that you love Israel? I live in Baltimore. Why would you tell me? I don't live in Israel. And then he realized that when they tell him they love Israel, what they're really saying is they love Jews. But the mirror image of this is that people come up to him and say they hate Israel. They might be telling them that really they hate Jews. And so this has just become code for some people. And we want to be able to detect that code. By observing patterns and using the IRA definition to adjudicate those patterns.
Great, thank you. Let me go over to Alan Goldberg's question here, related to the percent of DEI programs that include and teach and discuss anti-Semitism. Do we know anything about, actually programs that do that?
So I don't have those data, but I can tell you from having reviewed these 65 university DEI programs that there are, I did not see any centers that had any particular focus on Jews. There were the focus is on other ethnic and gender identities, and then also from trainings I can tell you about anti-Semitism tends not to be. I mean, and many of you are at universities and have had experience with having to go through those trainings, and it tends not to be an explicit part of those trainings. It's not a featured part. And so some of this is may flow from the ideological worldview that is associated with the DEI movement, and that ideological movement basically divides the world into categories of oppressor and oppressed, and that equity or justice demand that we treat the oppressor differently than the oppressed, and that the oppressor has privilege, and that the oppressor should have their privilege taken away, that equity and justice demand that. And then the problem is, well, who gets put into these categories of oppressor and oppressed? And the unfortunate pattern is that Jews get put typically into the category of oppressor. And once that happens, once we have this DEI worldview of being divided between oppressor and oppressed and calling it legitimate to treat those groups differently, and if Jews are in the oppressor category and should be treated differently, should have their privilege taken away, then in some ways that justifies the harsh or hurtful, hateful treatment that Jews receive. They deserve it then by this argument, because they're part of the oppressor group and they should have their privilege taken away. And therefore equity and justice demand that they be treated in this harsh way. And so I think it's that worldview that is central to the activism, the political and social activism of DEI staff, that I think is at the heart of the problem. We have to prevent that view from being legitimate on campus, and try to get rid of university staff who embrace and promote that worldview as part of what they think their university job is. That should not be the set of values that universities embrace and promote.
Great, thank you. So moving on to Bill Gardner's question, he has lived and taught at Chinese universities, and he makes a point here that Chinese universities all have a Communist Party office that effectively parallels the usual administration and much of the authority of the president. The role to enforce the Marxist ideology and the party orders. And so his question is, do you think it's valid to view the DEI apparatus as taking a similar function in American universities?
It's clearly attempting to perform a similar function. I don't think it has as much backing the political commissariat of the Chinese Communist Party. But that is the model by which they are functioning. That is, they're there to articulate and enforce an orthodox ideology. And in the case of China, that orthodox ideology is communism, or the Chinese Communist Party's version of communism. And in American universities, that orthodoxy is this kind of watered down Marxism of dividing the world into, instead of class categories, it's oppressor and oppressed categories. But I think there are a lot of similarities between those, and I think that's an excellent point.
Great. Moving on to Howard Berger's question. And so he says that the result of the study described disappropriate focus of DEI staff on criticism of Israel in social media. Do you have data on how this compares with non-DEI academic staff?
That's an excellent question. And I think that's, I love these questions that give me lots of ideas for additional research that can and should be done. And I encourage any of you to pursue these too, because there's a lot of work here to be done, but we don't know But it's an excellent question. I believe that that the pattern we observe for DEI staff is different, at least a little bit, from what we would observe if we simply looked at all university faculty. Again, I asserted earlier my belief that university faculty are more centrist than DEI staff, but I don't have evidence to prove that. But like a lot of things in life, we have, you know, theories and partial evidence without systematic evidence, but that's, we got to do our best with what we have until we can collect more systematic evidence. But I think that's an excellent new study to be done.
Let me ask you a question, Jay, and going just exactly to that point. Given what we're seeing here with the data that you've found, are these indicators that we can look at vis-a-vis not only anti-Semitism, but the rise of BDS on campuses, obviously in certain departments that we're seeing? Obviously, we have this growing specifically in the humanities. Now we're talking about different associations of late, the Middle East Studies Association. Is there a correlation that you're seeing there between the kind of DEI officers and the growth of BDS? Obviously, you know, we've seen that anecdotally around these campuses, but is there data that you've found that support that?
So, I mean, to be clear, that DEI staff are staff, not faculty. They're not academics. They're simply staff hired by the university, much like university hires student life staff. The growth of BDS in certain academic departments, however, resembles the growth of anti-Semitism in DEI, in that I think in both cases, I believe, although I don't have systematic evidence for it, that it represents the perspective of what is really a minority activist crowd. Again, I don't believe the vast majority of academics, and even within academic associations where they have considered or even adopted BDS resolutions, it doesn't mean that everyone in, or the vast majority of people in those fields believe it. But the kinds of people who get very involved in the governance of scholarly organizations tend to be people who have more extreme views, because they're why else would people be motivated to exert that energy in that direction? It's because they care intensely about something and want to use that position for some other purpose, like promoting their agenda. That would lead me to think that there's also hope in that there's a silent majority that can be mobilized to counter this effort by minority activists, both in DEI, control over university staff, but also, or university, BDI, control over university culture, but also the minority activist professors who seize scholarly organizations for these political purposes. I think that there are silent majorities that can be mobilized to counter these efforts pretty effectively. But it, you know, again, hearkening back to the Chinese Communist Party parallel, you know, people could be afraid and they're not likely to speak up if they think that it might be dangerous to do so.
Sure. Thank you. And to be clear, I mean, you know, again, my personal belief is that BDS is anti-Semitic based on the IRA definition and everything else that we're seeing. And so there's a, you know, they all go hand in hand. Obviously.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I thought that was understood as true.
Yeah, that is indeed understood to be true. I mean, obviously, we get all these conversations about anti-Zionism being legitimate criticism and anti-Semitism being racism. So I'm not one about them on the other. We are the belief that they are indeed synonymous in a lot of this. So to that point, you know, we're seeing now a growth of litigation when it comes to a lot of what's happening on campuses. Has the study itself proven, you know, useful from a legal standpoint as data to verify and to support these court cases that we're seeing now? We're seeing in CUNY, we've seen, you know, around the country. And when students and faculty are looking to show evidence of events happening on campus, is this helpful? You know, are these indicators that you can use when it comes to these kind of litigation if they are going to pursue that avenue?
So I'm not sure how this evidence fits into the legal strategies of those cases. But if it does, great, I'd be happy if that were true. My thought is that this kind of evidence is more likely to be used in political rather than in legal ways. That is, I can easily envision state legislators holding hearings where they call university presidents and chief diversity officers down to testify and have them answer questions about what exactly they're doing on campus, given this pattern that is observed nationally, as well as probably anecdotes they can generate from their own institution about anti-Semitism occurring there. I think that kind of political pressure, especially at state universities, will have a profound effect on the behavior of senior administration. And it's likely to rein in the anti-Semitism of DEI significantly if that political pressure were to be applied merely by calling out the university leadership in legislative hearings in different states. I also think major donors and alumni can use this information politically as well by contacting senior officials at universities, the donor relations people in particular, and expressing their concern given this evidence about those efforts. And I think that expression of concerns is also likely to lead to some response, as we did see at USC. But I think the problem is, what exact response do we want to have happen? And I think, you know, a first thing that we do want is the adoption of the IRA definition. I think that's clear. But and then I think a containment or even shrinkage of the DEI infrastructure would be another thing to hope for. But beyond that, the exact asks are a little bit hard to articulate. And I'm hopeful that smart people listening here will help us all collectively brainstorm for what those requests might be.
Great. Well, on that note, really, it's a good point. I think that, you know, unfortunately, our time is up, and I really do want to thank you again for taking the time to share your information, to share your data. It's critical and important to understand what's happening and what we're seeing. Obviously, I would love to have you back again, you know, when the next study comes out, and, you know, again, to share it and to, you know, present once again, you know, more findings and things that you're finding along the way. I want to thank Alex, as always, for joining me on our conversations. And of course, I want to thank everybody who attended this afternoon. I do apologize again. I know we had a lot more questions we did not get to. So please feel free to email us at bdsmonitor@svme.org, and we'll do our best to get them to Jay and get back to you in a timely fashion as far as an answer. So I really hope everybody is staying safe and healthy and warm wherever you guys are around the country and around the world. And Jay, of course, thank you for taking the time, and looking forward to continuing the conversation at a later date.
Great. Thank you very much for having me on. I look forward to coming back and participating in the audience or as a speaker in the future.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too.